don't forbid the priests, the other Harrys, entrance to the Empire. But at least I can make them unwelcome in my domain. The new barbarians will be equally unwelcome, if they ever arrive. As to the Anjin, son...
Torunaga shrugged.
But how long all this? Well, that's karma, ne?
Arvito was thanking God fervently for his mercy and favour at the unexpected reprieve.
Thank you, sire,
he said, hardly able to talk.
I know you'll not regret it. I pray that your enemies will be scattered like chaff, and that you may reap the rewards of heaven.
I'm sorry for my harsh words. They were spoken in anger. There's so much.
Torunaga got up ponderously.
You have my permission to say your service tomorrow, old friend.
Thank you, sire,
Arvito said, bowing low, pitying the normally majestic man.
Thank you with all my heart. May the divinity bless you and take you into his keeping.
Torunaga trudged into the inn, his guards following.
Naga-san?
Yes, father,
the youth said, hurrying up.
Where's the Lady Mariko?
There, sire, with Buntaro-san.
Naga pointed to the small lantern-lit char house inside its enclosure in the garden, the shadowed figures within.
Shall I interrupt the Chano-yu?
A Chano-yu was a formal, extremely ritualized tea ceremony.
No, that must never be interfered with. Where are Omi and Yabu-san?
They're at their inn, sir.
Naga indicated the sprawling low building on the other side of the river, near the far bank.
Who chose that one?
I did, sir. Please excuse me. You asked me to find them an inn on the other side of the bridge. Did I misunderstand you?
The Anjin-san.
He's in his room, sir. He's waiting in case you want him.
Again, Torunaga shook his head.
I'll see him tomorrow.
After a pause, he said in the same faraway voice,
I'm going to take a bath now. Then I don't wish to be disturbed till dawn, except...
Naga waited uneasily, watching his father stare sightlessly into space, greatly disconcerted by his manner.
Are you all right, father?
What? Oh, yes. Yes, I'm all right.
Why?
Nothing. Please excuse me. Do you still want to hunt at dawn?
Hunt?
Ah, yes. That's a good idea. Thank you for suggesting it. Yes, that would be very good. See to it.
Well, good night.
Oh, yes. The Tsuku-san has my permission to give a private service tomorrow. All Christians may go. You go also.
Sire?
On the first day of the new year, you will become a Christian.
Me?
Yes, of your own free will. Tell Tsuku-san privately.
Sire?
Torunaga wheeled on him.
Are you deaf? Don't you understand the simplest thing anymore?
Please excuse me.
Yes, father, I understand.
Good.
Torunaga fell back into his distracted attitude, then wandered off, his personal bodyguard in tow. All samurai bowed stiffly, but he took no notice of them. An officer came up to Naga, equally apprehensive.
What's the matter with our lord?
I don't know, Yoshinaka-san.
Naga looked back at the clearing. Alvito was just leaving, heading toward the bridge, a single samurai escorting him.
Must be something to do with him.
I've never seen Lord Torunaga walk so heavily. Never. They say that barbarian priest's a magician, a wizard. He must be to speak our tongue so well, ne? Could he have put a spell on our lord?
No, never. Not my father.
Barbarians make my spine shake too, Naga-san. Did you hear about the row? Tsuku-san and his band shouting and quarreling like ill-mannered Eta.
Yes. Disgusting. I'm sure that man must have destroyed my father's harmony.
If you ask me, an arrow in that priest's throat would save our master a lot of trouble.
Yes.
Perhaps we should tell Buntaro-san about Lord Torunaga.
He's our senior officer.
I agree, but later. My father said clearly I was not to interrupt the Chanoyu. I'll wait till he's finished.
In the peace and quiet of the little house, Buntaro fastidiously opened the small earthenware tea caddy of the Tang dynasty, and, with equal care, took up the bamboo spoon, beginning the final part of the ceremony. Deftly, he spooned up exactly the right amount of green powder, and put it into the handleless porcelain cup. An ancient cast-iron kettle was singing over the charcoal. With the same tranquil grace, Buntaro poured the bubbling water into the cup, replaced the kettle on its tripod, then gently beat the powder and water with the bamboo whisk to blend it perfectly. He added a spoonful of cool water, bowed to Mariko, who knelt opposite him, and offered the cup. She bowed and took it with equal refinement, admiring the green liquid, and sipped three times, rested, then sipped again, finishing it. She offered the cup back. He repeated the symmetry of the formal cha making and again offered it. She begged him to taste the cha himself, as was expected of her. He sipped, and then again, and finished it. Then he made a third cup and a fourth. More was politely refused. With great care, ritually he washed and dried the cup, using the peerless cotton cloth, and laid both in their places. He bowed to her, and she to him. The Chanoyu was finished. Buntaro was content that he had done his best, and that now, at least for the moment, there was peace between them. This afternoon, there had been none. He had met her palanquin. At once, as always, he had felt coarse and uncouth, in contrast to her fragile perfection. Like one of the wild, despised, barbaric, hairy Ainu tribesmen that once inhabited the land, but were now driven to the far north, across the straits, to the unexplored island of Hokkaido. All of his well-thought-out words had left him, and he clumsily invited her to the Chanoyu, adding, "It's years since we... I've never given one for you, but tonight will be convenient." Then he had blurted out, never meaning to say it, knowing that it was stupid, inelegant, and a vast mistake, "Lord Torunaga said it was time for us to talk."
"But you do not, sir?"
In spite of his resolve, he flushed and his voice rasped.
"I'd like harmony between us, yes, and more. I've never changed, ne?"
"Of course, sire. And why should you? If there's any fault, it's not your place to change, but mine. If any fault exists, it's because of me. Please excuse me."
"I'll excuse you," he said, towering over her there, beside the palanquin, deeply conscious that others were watching,
the Anjin-san and Omi among them. She was so lovely and tiny and unique, her hair piled high, her lowered eyes seemingly so demure, yet for him, filled now with that same black ice that always sent him into a blind, impotent frenzy, making him want to kill and shout and mutilate and smash and behave the way a samurai never should behave.
"I've reserved the cha house for tonight," he told her. "For tonight, after the evening meal. We're ordered to eat the evening meal with Lord Torunaga. I would be honored if you would be my guest afterwards."
"It's I who am honored."
She bowed and waited with the same lowered eyes, and he wanted to smash her to death into the ground, then go off and plunge his knife crisscross into his belly, and let the eternal pain cleanse the torment from his soul. He saw her look up at him discerningly.
"Was there anything else, sire?"
she asked, so softly. The sweat was running down his back and thighs, staining his kimono, his chest hurting like his head.
You're staying at the inn tonight."
Then he had left her and made careful dispositions for the whole baggage train. As soon as he could, he had handed his duties over to Naga and strode off with a pretended truculence down the riverbank. And when he was alone, he had plunged naked into the torrent, careless of his safety, and fought the river until his head had cleared and the pounding ache had gone. He lay on the bank collecting himself. Now that she had accepted, he had to begin. There was little time. He summoned his strength and walked back to the rough garden gate that was within the mother garden and stood there for a moment rethinking his plan. Tonight he wanted everything to be perfect. Obviously the hut was imperfect, like its garden, an uncouth provincial attempt at a real char house.
Never mind, he thought, now completely absorbed in his task. It will have to do. Night will hide many faults, and lights will have to create the form it lacks.
Servants had already brought the things he had ordered earlier. Tatamis, pottery oil lamps, and cleaning utensils. The very best in Yokose, everything brand new, but modest, discreet, and unpretentious. He stripped off his kimono, laid down his swords, and began to clean. First the tiny reception room and kitchen and veranda. Then the winding path and the flagstones that were let into the moss. And finally the rocks and skirting garden. He scrubbed and broomed and brushed until everything was spotless, letting himself swoop into the humility of manual labor that was the beginning of the Chano-Yu, where the host alone was required to make everything faultless. The first perfection was absolute cleanliness. By dusk, he had finished most of the preparations. Then he had bathed meticulously, endured the evening meal and the singing. As soon as he could, he had changed again into more somber clothes and hurried back to the garden. He latched the gate. First he put the taper to the oil lamps. Then, carefully, he sprinkled water on the flagstones and the trees that were now splashed here and there with flickering light, until the tiny garden was a fairyland of dewdrops dancing in the warmth of the summer's breeze. He repositioned some of the lanterns. Finally satisfied, he unlatched the gate and went to the vestibule. The carefully selected pieces of charcoal that had been placed punctiliously in a pyramid on white sand were burning correctly. The flowers seemed correct in the tokonoma. Once more he cleaned the already impeccable utensils. The kettle began to sing, and he was pleased with the sound that was enriched by the little pieces of iron he had placed so diligently in the bottom. All was ready. The first perfection of the Chano-Yu was cleanliness, the second, complete simplicity. The last and greatest, suitability to the particular guest or guests. He heard her footsteps on the flagstones, the sound of her dipping her hands ritually in the cistern of fresh river water and drying them. Three soft steps up to the veranda, two more to the curtained doorway. Even she had to bend to come through the tiny door that was made deliberately small to humble everyone. At the Chano-Yu, all were equal, host and guest, the most high daimyo and merest samurai. Even a peasant, if he was invited. First she studied her husband's flower arrangement. He had chosen the blossom of a single white wild rose and put a single pearl of water on the green leaf and set it on red stones. Autumn is coming, he was suggesting with the flower, talking through the flower. Do not weep for the time of fall, the time of dying, when the earth begins to sleep. Enjoy the time of beginning again, and experience the glorious cool of the autumn air on this summer evening. Soon the tear will vanish, and the rose. Only the stones will remain. Soon you and I will vanish, and only the stones will remain. He watched her, apart from himself, now deep in the near trance that a char master sometimes was fortunate enough to experience, completely in harmony with his surroundings. She bowed to the flower in homage, and came and knelt opposite him. Her kimono was dark brown, a thread of burnt gold at the seams, enhancing the white column of her throat and face. Her obi, the darkest of greens, that matched the under kimono. Her hair simple and unswept and unadorned.
You are welcome, he said with a bow, beginning the ritual.
It is my honor, she replied, accepting her role.
He served the tiny repast on a blemishless lacquered tray. The chopsticks placed just so, the slivers of fish on rice that he had prepared, a part of the pattern. And to complete the effect, a few wild flowers that he had found near the riverbank, scattered in perfect disarray. When she had finished eating, and he, in his turn, had finished eating, he lifted the tray, every movement formalized, to be observed and judged and recorded, and took it through the low doorway into the kitchen. Then alone, at rest, Mariko watched the fire critically. The coals a glowing mountain on a sea of stark white sand below the tripod. Her ears listening to the hissing sound of the fire melding with the sighing of the barely simmering kettle above. And from the unseen kitchen, the sibilance of cloth on porcelain and water cleaning the already clean. In time, her eyes wandered to the raw twisted rafters and to the bamboos and the reeds that formed the thatch. The shadows cast by the few lamps he had placed seemingly at random made the small large and the insignificant rare, and the whole a perfect harmony. After she had seen everything and measured her soul against it, she went again into the garden, to the shallow basin that over eons nature had formed in the rock. Once more she purified her hands and mouth with the cool, fresh water, drying them on a new towel. When she had settled back into her place, he said,
"Perhaps now you would take Cha."
"It would be my honour. But please do not put yourself to so much trouble on my account."
"It is my honour. You are my guest."
So he had served her, and now there was the ending. In the silence, Mariko did not move for a moment, but stayed in her tranquility, not wishing yet to acknowledge the ending or disturb the peace surrounding her. But she felt the growing strength of his eyes. The Chanoyu was ended. Now life must begin again.
"You did it perfectly," she whispered, her sadness overwhelming her.
A tear slid from her eyes, and the falling ripped the heart from his chest.
"No, no. Please excuse me. You are perfect. It was ordinary," he said, startled by such unexpected praise.
"It was the best I've ever seen," she said,
moved by the stark honesty in his voice.
"No, no, please excuse me. If it was fair, it was because of you, Mariko-san. It was only fair. You made it better."
"For me, it was flawless. Everything. How sad that others, more worthy than I, couldn't have witnessed it also."
Her eyes glistened in the flickering light.
"You witnessed it? That is everything. It was only for you. Others wouldn't have understood."
She felt the hot tears now on her cheeks. Normally she would have been ashamed of them, but now they did not trouble her.
"Thank you. How can I thank you?"
He picked up a sprig of wild thyme, and his fingers trembling, leaned over and gently caught one of her tears. Silently he looked down at the tear and the branchlet dwarfed by his huge fist.
"My work, any work, is inadequate against the beauty of this. Thank you."
He watched the tear on the leaf. A piece of charcoal fell down the mountain, and without thinking, he picked up the tongs and replaced it. A few sparks danced into the air from the mountaintop, and it became an erupting volcano. Both drifted into a sweet melancholia, joined by the simplicity of the single tear, content together in the quiet, joined in humility, knowing that what had been given had been returned in purity. Later, he said,
"If our duty did not forbid it, I would ask you to join me in death. Now."
"I would go with you."
"Gladly,"
she answered at once.
"Let us go to death. Now."
"We can't. Our duty is to Lord Toranaga."
She took out the stiletto that was in her obi and reverently placed it on the tatami.
"Then please allow me to prepare the way."
"No. That would be failing in our duty."
"What is to be, will be. You and I cannot turn the scale."
"Yes, but we may not go before our master. Neither you nor I. He needs every trustworthy vassal for a little longer. Please excuse me. I must forbid it."
"I would be pleased to go tonight. I'm prepared. More than that, I totally desire to go beyond. Yes, my soul is brimming with joy."
A hesitant smile.
"Please excuse me for being selfish. You're perfectly right about our duty."
The razor-sharp blade glistened in the candlelight. They watched it, lost in contemplation. Then he broke the spell.
"Why, Osaka,
Mariko-san?
There are things to be done there which only I can do.
His frown deepened as he watched the light from a guttering wick catch the tear and become refracted into a billion colors.
What things?
Things that concern the future of our house, which must be done by me.
In that case, you must go.
He looked at her searchingly.
But you alone?
Yes. I wish to make sure all family arrangements are perfect between us and Lord Kiyama for Saruji's marriage. Money and dowry and lands and so on. There's his increased fief to formalize. Lord Hiromatsu and Lord Torinaga require it done. I am responsible for the house.
Yes, he said slowly. That's your duty.
His eyes held hers.
If Lord Torinaga says you can go, then go. But it's not likely you'll be permitted there. Even so, you must return quickly, very quickly. It would be unwise to stay in Osaka a moment longer than necessary.
Yes.
By sea would be quicker than by road, but you've always hated the sea.
I still hate the sea.
Do you have to be there quickly?
I don't think half a month or a month would matter. Perhaps, I don't know. I just feel I should go at once.
Then we will leave the time and the matter of the going to Lord Torinaga, if he permits you to go at all. With Lord Zataki here and the two scrolls, that can only mean war. It will be too dangerous to go.
Yes. Thank you.
Glad that that was now finished, he looked around the little room contentedly, unconcerned now that his ugly bulk dominated the space, each of his thighs broader than her waist, his arms thicker than her neck.
This has been a fine room, better than I'd dared to hope. I've enjoyed being here. I'm reminded again that a body's nothing but a hut in the wilderness. Thank you for being here. I'm so glad you came to Yokose, Mariko-san. If it hadn't been for you, I would never have given a chano you here, and never felt so one with eternity.
She hesitated, then shyly picked up the Tang Cha caddy. It was a simple covered jar without adornment. The orange-brown glaze had run just short, leaving an uneven rim of bare porcelain at the bottom, dramatizing the spontaneity of the potter and his unwillingness to disguise the simplicity of his materials. Buntaro had bought it from Sen Nakada, the most famous cha master who had ever lived, for 20,000 koku.
It's so beautiful, she murmured, enjoying the touch of it. So perfect for the ceremony.
Yes.
You were truly a master tonight, Buntaro-san. You gave me so much happiness.
Her voice was low and intent, and she leaned forward a little.
Everything was perfect for me. The garden and how you used artistry to overcome the floors with light and shadow. And this.
Again she touched the char caddy.
Everything perfect. Even the character you'd written on the towel. I. Affection. For me, tonight, affection was the perfect word.
Again, tears spilled down her cheeks.
Please excuse me,
she said, brushing them away. He bowed, embarrassed by such praise. To hide it, he began to wrap the caddy in its silken sheaths. When he had finished, he set it into its box and placed it carefully in front of her.
Mariko-san, if our house has money problems, take this. Sell it?
Never.
It was the only possession, apart from his swords and longbow, that he prized in life.
That would be the last thing I would ever sell.
Please excuse me, but if pay for my vassals is a problem, take it.
There's enough for all of them, with care, and the best weapons, and the best horses. In that, our house is strong. No, Buntaro-san. The Tang is yours.
We've not much time left to us. Who should I will it to?
Saruji?
She looked at the coals and the fire consuming the volcano, humbling it.
No, Not until he's a worthy Charmaster, equaling his father. I counsel you to leave the Tang to Lord Torinaga, who's worthy of it, and ask him before he dies to judge if our son will ever merit receiving it.
And if Lord Torinaga loses and dies before winter, as I'm certain he'll lose?
What?
Here, in this privacy, I can tell you quietly that truth, without pretense. Isn't an important part of the Chanoyu to be without pretense? Yes, he will lose, unless he gets Kiyama and Onoshi, and Sateki.
In that case, set down in your will that the Tang should be sent with a cortege to His Imperial Highness. Petition him to accept it. Certainly the Tang merits divinity.
Yes, that would be the perfect choice.
He studied the knife, then added gloomily,
Ah, Mariko-san, there's nothing to be done for Lord Torinaga. His karma's written. He wins or he loses. And if he wins or loses, there'll be a great killing.
Yes.
Brooding, he took his eyes off her knife and contemplated the Wild Time sprig, the tear still pure. Later he said,
If he loses, before I die, or if I'm dead, I or one of my men will kill the Anjin son.
Her face was ethereal against the darkness. The soft breeze moved threads of her hair, making her seem even more statue-like.
Please excuse me. May I ask why?
He's too dangerous to leave alive. His knowledge, his ideas, that I've heard even fifth hand. He'll infect the realm, even Lord Yeamon. Lord Torinaga's already under his spell, eh?
Lord Torinaga enjoys his knowledge,
Mariko said.
The moment Lord Torinaga dies, that also is the Anjin San's death order. But I hope our Lord's eyes are opened before that time.
The guttering lamp spluttered and went out. He glanced up at her.
Are you under his spell?
He's a fascinating man, but his mind's so different from ours. His values. Yes, so different in so many ways that it's almost impossible to understand him at times. Once I tried to explain a Chanoyu to him, but it was beyond him.
It must be terrible to be born barbarian. Terrible,
Buntaro said.
Yes.
His eyes dropped to the blade of her stiletto.
Some people think the Anjin-san was Japanese in a previous life. He's not like other barbarians, and he tries hard to speak and act like one of us, though he fails, ne?
I wish you'd seen him almost commit seppuku, Buntaro-san. It was extraordinary. I saw death visit him, to be turned away by Omi's hand. If he was Japanese previously, I think that would explain many things. Lord Torinaga thinks he's very valuable to us now.
It's time you stopped training him and became Japanese again.
Sire?
I think Lord Torinaga's under his spell. And you.
Please excuse me, but I don't think I am.
That other night in Anjiro, the one that went bad, on that night I felt you were with him, against me. Of course it was an evil thought, but I felt it.
Her gaze left the blade. She looked at him steadily and did not reply. Another lamp spluttered briefly and went out. Now only one light remained in the room.
Yes, I hated him that night,
Buntaro continued in the same calm voice,
and wanted him dead. And you, and Hujiko-san. My bow whispered to me, like it does sometimes, asking for a killing. And when, the next dawn, I saw him coming down the hill with those cowardly little pistols in his hands, my arrows begged to drink his blood. But I put his killing off and humbled myself, hating my bad manners more than him, shamed by my bad manners and the sake.
His tiredness showed now.
So many shames to bear, you and I. Ne?
Yes.
You don't want me to kill him?
You must do what you know to be your duty, she said, as I will always do mine.
We stay at the inn tonight, he said.
Yes.
And then, because she had been a perfect guest, and the Chanoyu the best he had ever achieved, he changed his mind and gave her back time and peace in equal measure that he had received from her.
Go to the inn. Sleep, he said.
His hand picked up the stiletto and offered it.
When the maples are bare of leaves, or when you return from Osaka, we will begin again, as husband and wife.
Yes. Thank you.
Do you agree freely, Mariko-san?
Yes. Thank you.
Before your God?
Yes. Before God.
Mariko bowed and accepted the knife, replaced it in its hiding place, bowed again, and left. Her footsteps died away. Buntaro looked down at the branchlet still in his fist, the tears still trapped in a tiny leaf. His fingers trembled as they gently laid the sprig on the last of the coals. The pure green leaves began to twist and char. The tear vanished with a hiss. Then, in silence, he began to weep with rage, suddenly sure in his innermost being that she had betrayed him with the Anjin-san. Blackthorn saw her come out of the garden and walk across the well-lit courtyard. He caught his breath at the whiteness of her beauty. Dawn was creeping into the eastern sky.
Hello, Mariko-san!
Oh, hello, Anjin-san. You... so sorry. You startled me. I didn't see you there. You're up late.
Oh, gomen nasai. I'm on time.
He smiled and motioned to the morning that was not far off.
It's a habit I picked up at sea, to wake just before dawn, in good time to go aloft to get ready to shoot the sun.
His smile deepened.
It's you who are up late.
I didn't realize that it was... that night was gone.
Samurai were posted at the gates and all doorways, watching curiously, Naga among them. Her voice became almost imperceptible as she switched to Latin.
Guard thine eyes, I beg thee. Even the darkness of night contains harbingers of doom.
I beg forgiveness.
They glanced away as horses clattered up to the main gate. Falconers and the hunting party and guards. Dispiritedly, Toranaga came from within.
Everything's ready, sire, Naga said. May I come with you?
No. No, thank you.
You get some rest. Mariko-san, how was the Chanoyu?
Most beautiful, sire. Most very beautiful.
Buntaro-san's a master. You're fortunate.
Yes, sire.
Anjin-san, would you like to go hunting? I'd like to learn how you fly a falcon.
Sire?
Mariko translated at once.
Yes, thank you, Blackthorn said. Good.
Toranaga waved him to a horse.
You come with me.
Yes, sire.
Mariko watched them leave. When they had trotted up the path, she went to her room. Her maid helped her undress, remove her makeup, and take down her hair. Then she told the maid to stay in the room, that she was not to be disturbed until noon.
Yes, mistress.
Mariko lay down and closed her eyes and allowed her body to fall into the exquisite softness of the down quilts. She was exhausted and elated. The Chanoyu had pushed her to a strange height of peacefulness, cleansing her, and from there, the sublime, joy-filled decision to go into death had sent her to a further pinnacle never attained before. Returning from the summit into life once more had left her with an eerie, unbelievable awareness of the beauty of being alive. She had seemed to be outside herself as she answered Buntaro patiently, sure her answers and her performance had been equally perfect. She curled up in the bed, so glad that peace existed now. Until the leaves fell.
Oh, Madonna, she prayed fervently, I thank thee for thy mercy in granting me my glorious reprieve. I thank thee and worship thee with all my heart and with all my soul and for all eternity.
She repeated an Ave Maria in humility, and then, asking forgiveness, in accordance to her custom and in obedience to her liege lord, For another day, she put her god into a compartment of her mind.
What would I have done, she mused just before sleep took her, if Buntoro had asked to share my bed? I would have refused. And then, if he had insisted, as is his right, I would have kept my promise to him. Oh, yes. Nothing's changed.
Chapter 44. At the hour of the goat, the cortege crossed the bridge again. Everything was as before, except that now Zateki and his men were lightly dressed for travelling, or skirmishing. They were all heavily armed, and though very well disciplined, all were spoiling for the death fight, if it came. They seated themselves neatly opposite Toranaga's forces, which heavily outnumbered them. Father Alvito was to one side, among the onlookers. And Blackthorn. Toranaga welcomed Zateki with the same calm formality, prolonging the ceremonious seating. Today the two daimyos were alone on the dais, the cushions farther apart under a lower sky. Yabu, Omi, Naga, and Buntoro were on the earth surrounding Toranaga, and four of Zateki's fighting counselors spaced themselves behind him. At the correct time, Zateki took out the second scroll.
"I've come for your formal answer. I agree to go to Osaka and to submit to the will of the council," replied Toranaga evenly, and bowed. "You're going to submit?" Sataki began, his face twisting with disbelief. "You, Toranaga no Minowara, you're going—"
"Listen," Toranaga interrupted, in his resonant, commanding voice that ricocheted around the clearing without seeming to be loud.
"The Council of Regents should be obeyed. Even though it's illegal, it is constituted, and no single daimyo has the right to tear the realm apart, however much truth is on his side. The realm takes precedence. If one daimyo revolts, it is the duty of all to stamp him out. I swore to the Taiko I'd never be the first to break the peace, and I won't, even though evil is in the land. I accept the invitation. I will leave today."
Aghast, each samurai was trying to foretell what this unbelievable about-face would mean. All were achingly certain that most, if not all, would be forced to become ronin, with all that that implied. Loss of honor, of revenue, of family, of future. Buntaro knew that he would accompany Toranaga on his last journey and share his fate. Death with all his family, of all generations. Ishido was too much his own personal enemy to forgive. And anyway, who would want to stay alive when his own lord gave up the true fight in such cowardly fashion?
"Kama," Buntaro thought bitterly. "Buddha, give me strength. Now I'm committed to take Mariko's life and our son's life before I take my own. When? When my duty's done and our lord is safely and honorably gone into the void. You will need a faithful second, ne? All gone. Like autumn leaves. All the future and the present. Crimson sky and destiny. It's just as well, ne? Now Lord Yeamon will surely inherit. Lord Toranaga must be secretly tempted in his most private heart to take power, however much he denies it. Perhaps the Taiko will live again through his son, and in time will war on China again, and win this time, to stand at the summit of the world, as is our divine duty. Yes, the Lady Ochiba and Yeamon won't sell us out next time, as Ishido and his cowardly supporters did the last."
Naga was bewildered.
"No crimson sky? No honorable war? No fighting to the death in the Shinano Mountains or on the Kyoto Plains? No honorable death in battle, heroically defending the standard of his father? No mounds of enemy dead to straddle in a last glorious stand or in a divine victory? No charge, even with the filthy guns? None of that. Just a seppuku. Probably hurried, without pomp or ceremony or honor,
and his head stuck on a spike for common people to jeer at. Just a death, and the end of the Yoshi line. For of course, every one of them would die. His father, all his brothers and sisters and cousins, nephews and nieces and aunts and uncles. His eyes focused on Zateki. Bloodlust began to flood his brain. Bomi was watching Toranaga with half-seeing eyes, hatred devouring him.
Our master's gone mad, he thought. How can he be so stupid? We've 100,000 men and the musket regiment and 50,000 more around Osaka. Crimson Sky's a million times better than a lonely, stinking grave.
His hand was heavy on his sword hilt, and for an ecstatic moment he imagined himself leaping forward to decapitate Toranaga, to hand the head to the regent Zateki, and so end the contemptuous charade. Then to die by his own hand with honor, here, before everyone. For what was the point of living now? Now Kiku was beyond his reach, her contract bought and owned by Toranaga, who had betrayed them all. Last night his body had been on fire during her singing, and he knew her song had been secretly for him, and him alone. Unrequited fire. Him and her.
Wait, why not a suicide together? To die beautifully together, to be together for all eternity. Oh, how wonderful that would be! To mix our souls in death as a never-ending witness to our adoration of life. But first, the traitor Toranaga, ne?
With an effort, Omi dragged himself back from the brink.
Everything's gone wrong, he thought. No peace in my house, always anger and quarrelling, and Midori always in tears. No nearer my revenge on Yabu. No private secret arrangement with Zateki, with or without Yabu, negotiated over the hours last night. No deal of any kind. Nothing right anymore. Even when Mura found the swords, both were so mutilated by the Earth's force that I know Toranaga hated me for showing them to him. Now, finally this. This cowardly, traitorous surrender. It's almost as though I'm bedeviled in an evil spell. Cast by the Anjin-san? Perhaps. But everything's still lost. No swords, and no revenge. And no secret escape route. And no Kiku. And no future. Wait. There's a future with her. Death's a future, and past and present. And it'll be so clean and simple.
You're giving up? We're not going to war?
Yabu bellowed, aware that his death and the death of his life were now guaranteed.
I accept the Council's invitation, Toranaga replied. As you will accept the Council's invitation. I won't do.
Omi came out of his reverie with enough presence of mind to know that he had to interrupt Yabu and protect him from the instant death that any confrontation with Toranaga would bring. But he deliberately froze his lips, shouting to himself with glee at this heaven-sent gift, and waited for Yabu's disaster to overtake him.
You won't do what?
Toranaga asked. Yabu's soul shrieked danger. He managed to croak,
I... Of course, your vassals will obey. Yes, if you decide. Whatever you decide, I will do.
Mummy cursed and allowed the glazed expression to return, his mind still withered by Toranaga's totally unexpected capitulation. Angrily, Toranaga let Yabu stutter on, increasing the strength of the apology. Then, contemptuously, he cut him short.
Good.
He turned back to Zateki, but he did not relax his vigil.
So, brother, you can put away the second scroll. There's nothing more.
From the corner of his eye, he saw Naga's face change, and he wheeled on him.
Naga!
The youth almost leapt out of his skin, but his hand left his sword.
Yes, father,
he stammered.
Go and fetch my writing materials. Now!
When Naga was well out of sword range, Toranaga exhaled, relieved that he had prevented the attack on Zateki before it had begun. His eyes studied Buntaro carefully, then Omi, and last Yabu. He thought the three of them were now sufficiently controlled not to make any foolish move that would precipitate an immediate riot and a great killing. Once again, he addressed Sataki.
"I'll give you my formal written acceptance at once. This will prepare the council for my state visit."
He lowered his voice and spoke for Zataki's ears alone.
"Inside Izu, you're safe, Regent. Outside it, you're safe. Until my mother's out of your grasp, you're safe. Only until then. This meeting is over." "Good. State visit?"
Sataki was openly contemptuous.
"What hypocrisy! I never thought I'd see the day when Yoshitora Naga no Minowara would kowtow to General Ishido. You're just..."
"Which is more important, brother?" Toranaga said. "The continuity of my line, or the continuity of the realm?"
Gloom hung over the valley. It was pouring now, the base of the clouds barely 300 feet from the ground, obscuring completely the way back up the pass. The clearing and the inn's forecourt were filled with shoving, ill-tempered samurai. Horses stamped their feet irritably. Officers were shouting orders with unnecessary harshness. Frightened porters were rushing about, readying the departing column. Barely an hour remained to darkness. Toranaga had written the flowery message and signed it, sending it by messenger to Zataki, over the entreaties of Buntaro, Omi, and Yabu, in private conference. He had listened to their arguments silently. When they had finished, he said,
"I want no more talk. I've decided my path. Obey."
He had told them he was returning to Anjiro immediately to collect the rest of his men. Tomorrow he would head up the East Coast Road toward Atami and Odawara, thence over the mountain passes to Edo. Buntaro would command his escort. Tomorrow the musket regiment was to embark on the galleys at Anjiro and put to sea to await him at Edo, Yabu in command. The following day, Omi was ordered to the frontier by the central road with all available Izu warriors. He was to assist Hiromatsu, who was in overall command, and was to make sure that the enemy, Ikawa Jikyu, did nothing to interfere with normal traffic. Omi was to base himself in Mishima for the time being, to guard that section of the Tokaido Road, and to prepare palanquins and horses in sufficient quantity for Toranaga and the considerable entourage that was necessary to a formal state visit.
"Alert all stations along the road and prepare them equally. You understand?"
"Yes, sire."
"Make sure that everything's perfect."
"Yes, sire. You may rely on me."
Even Omi had winced under the baleful glare. When everything was ready for his departure, Toranaga came out from his rooms onto the veranda. Everyone bowed. Sourly, he motioned them to continue and sent for the innkeeper. The man fawned as he presented the bill on his knees. Toranaga checked it item by item. The bill was very fair. He nodded and threw it at his paymaster for payment, then summoned Mariko and the Anjin-san. Mariko was given permission to go to Osaka.
"But first you'll go directly from here to Mishima. Give this private dispatch to Hiromatsu-san. Then continue on to Edo with the Anjin-san. You're responsible for him until you arrive. You'll probably go by sea to Osaka. I'll decide that later. Anjin-san, did you get the dictionary from the priest-san?"
"Please, so sorry, I don't understand."
Mariko translated.
"Sorry. Yes, I book got. When we meet in Edo, you'll speak better Japanese than you do now. Wakarimasu ka?"
"Hai, gomen nasai."
Despondently, Toranaga stomped out of the courtyard, a samurai holding a large umbrella for him against the rain. As one, all samurai porters and villagers again bowed. Toranaga paid no attention to them, just got into his roofed palanquin at the head of the column, and closed the curtains. At once, the six semi-naked bearers raised the litter and started off at a loping trot, their horny bare feet splashing the puddles. Mounted escorting samurai rode ahead, and another mounted guard surrounded the palanquin. Spare porters and the baggage train followed, all hurrying, all tense and filled with dread. Omi led the van. Buntero was to command the rearguard. Yabu and Naga had already left for the musket regiment that was still athwart the road in ambush to await Toranaga at the crest. It would fall in behind to form a rearguard.
Rearguard against whom?
Yabu had snarled at Omi in the few moments of privacy they had had before he galloped off. Buntero strode back to the high, curved gateway of the inn, careless of the downpour.
Mariko-san?
Obediently she hurried to him, her orange oiled paper umbrella beaten by the heavy drops.
Yes, sir?
His eyes raced over her under the brim of his bamboo hat, then went to Blackthorn, who watched from the veranda.
Tell him!
He stopped.
Sir?
He stared down at her.
Tell him I hold him responsible for you.
Yes, sir, she said. But please excuse me. I am responsible for me.
Buntero turned and measured the distance to the head of the column. When he glanced back, his face showed a trace of his torment.
Now there'll be no falling leaves for our eyes, eh?
That is in the hands of God, sir.
No, that's in Lord Taranaga's hands,
he said with disdain. She looked up at him without wavering under his stare. The rain beat down. Droplets fell from the rim of her umbrella like a curtain of tears. Mud splattered the hem of her kimono. Then he said,
Sayonara, until I see you at Osaka.
She was startled.
Oh, so sorry. Won't I see you at Edo? Surely you'll be there with Lord Toranaga. You'll arrive about the same time, ne? I'll see you then.
Yes, but at Osaka. When we meet there, or when you return from there. Then we begin again. That's when I'll truly see you, ne?
Ah, I understand. So sorry.
Sayonara, Mariko-san, he said.
Sayonara, my lord.
Mariko bowed. He returned her obeisance peremptorily and strode through the quagmire to his horse. He swung into the saddle and galloped away without looking back.
Go with God, she said, staring after him.
Blackthorn saw her eyes following Buntero. He waited in the lee of the roof, the rain lessening. Soon the head of the column vanished into the clouds, then Toranaga's palanquin, and he breathed easier, still shattered by Toranaga and the whole ill-omened day. This morning the hawking had begun so well. He had chosen a tiny, long-winged falcon, like a merlin, and flew her very successfully at a lark, the stoop and soaring chase blown southward beyond a belt of trees by the freshening wind. Leading the charge, as was his privilege, he careered through the forest along a well-beaten path, itinerant peddlers and farmers scattering. But a weather-beaten oil seller with an equally threadbare horse blocked the way and cantankerously wouldn't budge. In the excitement of the chase, Blackthorn had shouted at the man to move, but the peddler would not, so he cursed him roundly. The oil seller replied rudely and shouted back, and then Toranaga was there, and Toranaga pointed at his own bodyguard and said,
Anjin-san, give him your sword a moment,
and some other words he did not understand. Blackthorn obeyed at once. Before he realized what was happening, the samurai lunged at the peddler. His blow was so savage and so perfect that the oil seller had walked on a pace before falling, divided in two at the waist. Toranaga had pounded his pommel with momentary delight, then fell back into his melancholy as the other samurai had cheered. The bodyguard cleansed the blade carefully, using his silken sash to protect the steel. He sheathed the sword with satisfaction and returned it, saying something that Mariko explained later.
He just said, Anjin-san, that he was proud to be allowed to test such a blade. Lord Toranaga is suggesting you should nickname the sword Oil Seller, because such a blow and such sharpness should be remembered with honor. Your sword has now become legend, ne?
Blackthorn recalled how he had nodded, hiding his anguish. He was wearing Oil Cellar now. Oil Cellar it would be forevermore. The same sword that Toranaga had presented to him.
I wish she'd never given it to me, he thought. But it wasn't all their fault. It was mine too. I shouted at the man. He was rude in return, and samurai may not be treated rudely. What other course was there?
Blackthorn knew there was none. Even so, the killing had taken the joy out of the hunt for him, though he had to hide that carefully, because Toranaga had been moody and difficult all day. Just before noon, they'd returned to Yokose. Then there was Toranaga's meeting with Zataki, and then after a steaming bath and massage, suddenly Father Alvito was standing in his way, like a vengeful wraith, two hostile acolytes in attendance.
Christ Jesus, get away from me!
There's no need to be afraid or to blaspheme, Alvito had said.
God curse you and all priests, Blackthorn said,
trying to get hold of himself, knowing that he was deep in enemy territory. Earlier, he'd seen 50 Catholic samurai trickling over the bridge to the mass that Mariko had told him was being held in the forecourt of Alvito's inn. His hand sought the hilt of his sword, but he was not wearing it with his bathrobe, or carrying it as was customary, and he cursed his stupidity, hating to be unarmed.
May God forgive you, your blasphemy, Pilate. Yes. May he forgive you and open your eyes. I bear you no malice. I came to bring you a gift. Here's a gift from God, Pilate.
Blackthorn took the package suspiciously. When he opened it and saw the Portuguese-Latin-Japanese dictionary grammar, a thrill rushed through him. He leafed through a few pages. The printing was certainly the best he had ever seen, the quality and detail of the information staggering.
Yes, this is a gift from God, all right, but Lord Toranaga ordered you to give it to me.
We obey only God's orders.
Toranaga asked you to give it to me?
Yes, it was his request.
And a Toranaga request isn't an order?
That depends, Captain Pilate, on who you are, what you are, and how great your faith.
Alvito motioned at the book.
Three of our brethren spent 27 years preparing that.
Why are you giving it to me?
We were asked to.
Why didn't you avoid Lord Toranaga's request? You're more than cunning enough to do that.
Alvito shrugged. Quickly Blackthorn flicked through all the pages, checking.
Excellent paper. The printing very clear.
The numbers of the pages were in sequence.
It's complete, Alvito said, amused. We don't deal with half-books.
This is much too valuable to give away. What do you want in return?
He asked us to give it to you. The father visitor agreed. So you are given it. It was only printed this year, at long last.
It's beautiful, isn't it?
We only ask you to cherish it, to treat the book well.
It's worth treating well. It's worth guarding with a life. This is priceless knowledge, like one of your rutters. But this is better. What do you want for it?
We ask nothing in return.
I don't believe you.
Blackthorn weighed it in his hand, even more suspiciously.
You must know this makes me equal to you. It gives me all your knowledge and saves us 10, maybe 20 years. With this, I'll soon be speaking as well as you. Once I can do that, I can teach others. This is the key to Japan, eh? Language is the key to anywhere foreign, eh? In 6 months, I'll be able to talk direct to Toranaga-sama.
Yes, perhaps you will. If you have 6 months.
What does that mean?
Nothing more than what you already know. Lord Toranaga will be dead long before 6 months is up.
Why? What news did you bring him? Ever since he talked with you, he's been like a bull with half its throat ripped out. What did you say, eh?
My message was private, from His Eminence to Lord Toranaga. I'm sorry. I'm merely a messenger. But General Ishido controls Osaka, as you surely know.